statistical consideration in conducting landscape-level soil studies. My co-author is hiding somewhere in the back, Joey Shaw. Just raise your hand there. He is responsible for all the soils questions. Yeah. Well, we'll do that. Okay. Okay. But that was fine. It was large enough for me. Okay, what I'm going to do is going to outline potential problems in soil science studies, then introduce a specific study, and present materials and methods and some results in light of those problems, or you may call them opportunities, and then tie everything together together in the end. Somewhere. Okay, potential problems in landscape scale studies already start with site identification. It's not as easy as you might think. Replication is another problem area, and the fact that we have multiple, if not numerous, response variables. And lastly, variance-related issues, such as heterogeneous variances and a correlated error structure. The Soil Survey of the United States utilizes a soil landscape model to arrive at natural soil bodies that are similar due to soil formation processes. These natural bodies are grouped together into map units. This is a basic unit of the soil survey. And surveys are based on what's called use invariant soil properties, more properly labeled largely use invariant soil properties, as I will show in a minute. And these surveys are then used for natural resource planning by, quote-unquote, predicting soil behavior for specific uses, such as agronomic development or waste disposal. The once-over National Cooperative Soil Survey is nearing completion and transitions to a maintenance and update model. And in this mode, that emphasis will be on anthropogenic effects on soil natural resources. Soils are not static entities, but variable. And the spatial variability is related to the way the soils were formed, and the temporal variability is defined as the variability of a given soil at a given location over time. And this variability is referred to as soil change. This change has both natural and anthropogenic components. The natural component would occur over long time spans, whereas the management-induced changes would be measured on a human scale, lifetime scale. And typically, these management-dependent properties are assessed in near-surface layer and are then used to evaluate soil quality. Soil quality is one of those terms that doesn't have a real rigorous definition, but as one of our Supreme Court judges years ago noted in a different context, I know it when I see it. Research over the last 20 years has shown that soil organic carbon is one of the most sensitive indicators of soil quality for agronomic utilization. Soil quality and soil organic carbon has also come to the forefront with increased awareness of global climatic change as it relates to rising atmospheric CO2 levels. In this context, it is of interest how much CO2 can sequestered in a given soil. This, in terms, has implications for policy issues such as carbon trading. The particular map unit chosen for this study is the Dothan map unit, and it's chosen because it has it extends over the wide range in the southeastern United States, ranging from Alabama all the way to the Carolinas. Within this unit, the Doherty Plain was chosen, and here it is located in this very southeastern corner of Alabama. It covers close to 20 million acres, I would say, in Alabama, Georgia, and northern Florida. And it is important because it is considered prime farmland. It also has ecological significance because a lot of it sits on top of an important eastern United States aquifer. The wiregrass region of southwestern Alabama, the Dorothy Plain portion of the wiregrass region, is well suited for this type of study because we have the range of agronomic and forestry land uses. The objective of this study was to compare these land uses. The limitation was that it had to be in a particular land use for at least 10 years. The natural climax vegetation is the longleaf pine wiregrass association, which is characterized by longleaf pine and an understory of primarily wiregrass but other forbs as well. It is a fire-regulated natural ecosystem with periodic fires which promote regeneration of the pine as well as the wiregrass. And the wiregrass, that's an Aristida species. And, of course, for nutrient cycling, it's also important. The fires are also important. Now, planted pine have a lifespan of about 25 years, give or take 5 years. And it starts with a severe soil disturbance to remove old stumps from the previous planting and prepare the ground for transplanting. It is then periodically disturbed due to thinning and weed control. Prescribed burns are also part of the management system to control the fire load in the understory so it won't come to catastrophic fires during extremely dry years. The grazed pasture has a life expectancy of about 20 years, and it would be primarily Bahia grass, Paspalum notatum, and would experience minimal disturbance after establishment. The most soil disturbance is experienced in the conventional row crop system where multiple tillage operations are necessary to prepare the ground for crop establishment. Traditional crops would be peanuts and cotton, but also corn, soybeans, winter grains such as wheat and oats, or winter grazing pasture, annual ryegrass. Conservation cropping in this area has increased slowly but steadily over the last 15 years. And in this system, soil disturbance is much reduced and may consist of simple in-row subsoiling or strip tillage, but never experience, or rarely, should we say, experience any wholesale disturbance. And as I said, all these land uses are located within a Dothan map unit. Replication. The replication serves a different function in this type of study. In control studies, we use experimental design principles, experimental conduct, and statistical adjustment to reduce the noise portion of the signal so we can have more accurate or better treatment comparisons. The function of replication in this type of study is different. We would like to capture the true underlying variability. And if we don't do it, we're going to have a problem because we are increasing our type 1 error rate and concluding that there are treatment differences or differences in land use for a particular trait or response variable that we're looking at, when there really is no evidence to support such a contention. One cause would be a so-called, what people like to call, technical replication. In other words, laboratory duplicates. That certainly would give you an artificially low error term. Less problematic would be to subdivide a polygon and then in these blocks take your samples and use the variability among these blocks as your error term. I would call this pseudo-replication because it will underestimate the true extent of natural variability. Statistically, these studies would be a split, would be a randomized completely randomized design with a split block restriction on randomization since we sample by depth. Again, here is the Alabama in the southeastern corner of the Doherty Plain, and then here the replicates. Now, if these may appear close together, but that's a function of the scale of the map. Each of these is located in a different polygon. Just as a reminder, each polygon is represented by its 20 samples, which are then composited to reflect or represent that particular polygon. Problem is with site selection that you cannot replicate a particular land use. As I mentioned before, conservation systems appeared about 15 years ago, and this is an instance where we did not have several polygons that met the criteria that were established for this study. What do you do in this situation? Well, you could simply say, in the planning, can't find them. We're not going to look into that land use. The problem is we would like to have some information, and we really don't want to wait another 10 years for that, because chances are we may lose another land use, and we would be no better off. Second option is you take the data, you do everything, and use it for personal edification. So your students, your research group, they will know what's going on. You may talk about it like this and treat it like a secret, but you don't publish it because you're afraid of the reviewers. We've all been there, right? If you're in an academic setting, you've been there. Okay? I'm not knocking this choice. This is a perfectly acceptable route for someone in the quest for tenure. Do not laugh. That's a serious matter. As one somebody in the workshop yesterday was mentioning a key take-home message that he or key message that he had received during graduate school. Mine was that one of my professors got philosophical and just simply stated that your first and foremost objective when you get an academic position is to get tenure. Because without tenure, your medium and long-term objectives or goals that you have will not matter because they will not let you. So it is a perfectly acceptable choice, but not one that I would advocate. And you probably know by now where I'm driving from. I said, publish this stuff. And in fact, I've been involved in an environmental study where we had a similar situation. We made our arguments to the reviewers. They bought it. And it's in print. Now, when you do that, of course, it requires that some of your treatments or groups have a measure of precision associated with it. You can't now do the extreme and say, well, I'm just going to publish, in fact, five numbers, and that's going to be my, for a given response, and that's going to be my thing, my contribution. I mean, you have to have replication, because after all, that enables us to judge whether or not the differences observed have a statistical backing. And it gets information out there that is needed. In terms of data analysis, we have numerous response variables, sometimes a multitude of variables, and we run into a situation of can't see the forest for the trees problem. I don't know what culture you come from, but I bet you every culture has a concept like that. I just learned the one of southern India. It has to do with a haystack and not being able to see that stack for all the grass blades that you're seeing. We have that. So it's information overload. We cannot see a complete picture. That's where multivariate analysis can really be of service. But unlike fields like social sciences, where they're perfectly comfortable with using derived variables, soil scientists still like individual response variables, such as bulk density. So we can use multivariate analysis for two purposes. One is to get an overall assessment, and secondly, give us an idea of what response variables to concentrate on without having any preconceived notions that some should not be important. And in this particular context, I like canonical discriminant analysis because it is a class-directed technique. Often soil scientists use PCA variable-directed techniques when they in fact have classes already. And see, we have these classes called management or land use classes. And we have replication. So, and this works for canonical discriminant analysis because it works on maximizing among group and minimizing within group variation. But not all responses are created equal. They're not all measured at all depths. So a little creativity is called for when doing the analysis. And you're limited in the analysis really only by your imagination. Multivariate statistic operates on an N by P matrix of N observations, P variables, and N is generally greater than P. The important thing here is that these P variables, there is a correlation assumption. If you have P variables that are not correlated at all with each other, each variable will tell a unique story. And multivariate analysis doesn't help you. The other extreme, if you have two variables that are perfectly correlated, that's just duplicate information, and one of those will have to go before you can do the analysis. When you look at multivariate analysis, there's a whole plethora of analysis. I call it theme and variation. I like classical music, so I like theme and variation. Principal component analysis and factor analysis, they are analyses basically concerned with the variables themselves and the relationship and trying to create derived variables from those. You could call it a narcissistic approach to analysis. Discriminant analysis, on the other hand, you have a matrix of P correlated variables from which you create linear functions that then are used to predict the class differences of pre-existing groups. Take it a step further, you have two matrices, and you are into canonical correspondence analysis territory. Favorite tool for ecologists. You might have one matrix here of stream physical and chemical characteristics. The other matrix might be biological characteristics of that environment. And you're trying to explain the biological characteristics based on the physical characteristics. Had a study like that several years ago on stream biology. Lastly, in multiple regression, we have a matrix of related or not unrelated variables, which we then trying to combine parsimoniously to predict the quantitative changes in the Y matrix. But underlying all is some sort of an N by P matrix. Okay, let's have a look at these largely used invariant variables that were used for site characterization and see if this assumption really holds. So we have soil texture, CEC, mineralogy, and morphological characteristics, and these were taken in the control section, the upper level of the argillic horizon. Applying canonical discriminant analysis to these variables, we see that the first canonical variate accounted for 99% of the multivariance, so virtually captured all of it. We also see here that these different land uses are situated along the CAN1 axis, and the two circled ones here are not significantly different from another, but are significantly different from the others, based on the Mihalanobis distance, the p-values, which were adjusted by the Bonferroni method. So it's pretty severe p-value adjustment. Now, when you do this type of analysis, you can go back and look at in this case, the phenotypic correlation, the correlation based on means between the original variable, Gibbsite, and the canonical variate. The correlation here is 0.99, very high. So I would argue that the differences here among the sites are driven by Gibbsite content. And my co-author would be more than happy to explain to you why that isn't really all that surprising. Well, if you're not familiar with correlation coefficients, one way to look at correlations is as a cosine of the angle between two vectors. Okay, if you take the black line here and the dashed black line, the x and y axis, or CAN1 and CAN2, angle is 90 degrees, cosine 0, correlation 0. This is the principle of canonical discriminant analysis. The new variables are not correlated with one another. Well, this reflects the situation, the red vector here, the angle for Gibbsite. The larger the correlation, the smaller the angle between the two vectors. And hence my contention that Gibbsite differences are driving the distribution of management sites along CAN1. And we can see here is that conventional plus conservation versus a planted pine versus a middle one is significant, and the two extremes are also significantly different based on Gibbsite content. So the analysis of variance confirms what we already concluded without ever having looked at a single mean. Now let's look at the management-dependent variables in this study. There's a whole slew of them. I mean, from soil strength to CEC, nutrients to saturated hydraulic conductivity. They are taken by depth, 4 depths, 0 to 5, 5 to 15, 15 to 30, and 30 to 50 centimeters, but not all variables are assessed at all depth. So what I did for this presentation, I simply did a subset of physical traits, chemical or nutrient traits, and the organic pool, and used that in the analysis. And these were all assessed at all four depths. And one of the drawbacks to multivariate analysis is that missing observations can hurt you, because a single observation within a row, missing observation within a row, will usually eliminate that from the analysis. Now, there are ways to impute that missing value if you don't have too many, but nevertheless, it's something you would like to avoid. Okay. The correlation. These are just simply the nutrients given in concentration above the diagonal and on the mass basis below the diagonal. The greens are correlation between 0.5 and 0.7, and the purple 0.7 and above. And so you see these variables are correlated. And if you work in soils, it's really no big surprise, but just serves as a reminder that we have this existing. Now, when we plot the canonical means, in other words, the means of the two canonical variates, we get this picture. In the bottom left, we have our longleaf pine. In the bottom right, our conventional cropping. We have our conservation system here, our pasture, and then the planted pine. The blue arrows indicate which of the original variables are the driving forces for the difference along that axis. Boat density, pH, negative correlation going from here to here, total organic carbon, calcium, water dispersible clay, and in the other direction, magnesium, iron, copper, clay dispersion ratio, and total organic nitrogen. We had 12 original variables, so it's 12-dimensional space. We reduced that to 2, and we have captured 58 plus 24, so 82% of the total multivariance. Interest and this relationship here, particularly when you look at total organic carbon, won't surprise anybody. This longleaf pine has a high carbon pool. Row crops land, conventional row crop land in the southeastern United States, it's extremely low in carbon. The planted pine, in terms of the carbon, is somewhere in between these two extremes, but it is higher in total organic nitrogen. And that's a good topic for discussion, why this actually makes sense. Now, similar to analysis of variance and regression, the underlying observations can overlap, yet the means can still be significantly different. And that's what you see here for some instances. The planted pine and the pasture have overlapping observations, but longleaf pine, planted pine, and conventional cropping does not. Here, of course, you have 12 points for these because we had 3 replicates and 4 depth, but for conservation, we of course only have the 4 depth, but we nevertheless included it in the analysis. When we look at the driving forces, we see very high correlations for bulk density, pH, either measured water or salt, total organic carbon, this negative correlation, calcium, water dispersible clay. For CAN2, we have our nutrients, clay dispersion ratio, and total organic nitrogen. Let's look at the total organic carbon just because we can. And look at the residuals for total organic carbon concentration. First of all, we only have a single residual number here, and that indicates we do not have replication, true replication. Notice here the small variance for the conventional treatment. And this would be the variance across the 3 polygons at the 0 to 5 depth. And there's not much difference as you go deeper into the horizon. On the other hand, on the pasture system, we have a large variance among location for the upper level and then reducing to a small, very small value for the deepest layer sampled. And so we can see here that 2 things we have to take into account: heterogeneity of variance, both for the treatments as well as accounting for the depth. When modeling the residual variance, is one of the first things you should really do is use an unstructured matrix to get an idea of really what that variance looks like, that variance structure. Now, it doesn't mean that it is the ultimate model, but it gives you some hints where the analysis might lead you. First of all, in green, we have the variances for each depth, and I don't believe you can say that they're homogeneous. I mean, that's 2 orders of magnitude difference here. And So whatever model is chosen has to take that fact into account. The second one is, if you look for the 0 to 5 depth and look at the covariance with the remaining depths, you can see as you have intervening layer, that covariance is much reduced. So the ultimate model or structure that you choose also has to take that into account. And this is a picture that this using an unstructured variance can give you. Now, if your data set is very large, you may not be able to do it because it's very computationally intensive. So, how to deal with variances? Certainly, we do not want to underestimate the natural variation. So we want to avoid technical and pseudo-replication problems. Secondly, we have to take into account heterogeneity of variances, both at the main plot and the subplot factors. And ignorance is never a good approach. We have to take into a correlated error structure. This is a fact of life because we sample by depth. The minute you sample by depth, you have this correlated error structure, whether you like it or not. You can model this covariance structure. But probably you're well to do to keep in mind that all models are wrong, as George Box claimed, but some just happen to be useful. So what you're doing is you're trying to come close to the truth. But you do not know the real state of nature. So you have to realize that these landscape studies pose unique challenges, which many of those you can address in the planning stages. As I indicated, modeling variances is an absolute must, but it's not going to be easy. So cookbooking won't really work. Opening whatever your favorite textbook is, says this is the way you do it, doesn't work. Because the covariance structure will likely be different for each variable that you're addressing. So just because it worked for total organic carbon, you have no assurance that that model will work for calcium. Lastly, multivariate techniques can be helpful to paint a complete picture. And I don't want to stretch this analogy too far, but what you want to wind up with is not a collection of trees, but a forest in which you paint or highlight certain important trees or variables. And if you do that, writing a manuscript, writing a report, extending that information to the end user is like telling a story. It's gripping, and you have something to tell. Thank you. Overfitting your model, probably the danger is underfitting, but I use fit statistics, such as, and the penalized fit statistics. Are you familiar with, like, the information criterion statistics? And basically, if you're not familiar with it, they serve the same function as the penalized R-squared in regression. The more terms you put into the model, the heavier the penalty will be. So, and that generally prevents you from overfitting.
And are you able to apply that in CDA?
Yes. Well, in CDA, if you're referring to CDA, multivariate analysis is much an art as it is a science. Okay. And that's why I personally use it not as an end in itself, but tell me
where I need to go in the analysis of all the multitudes of variables that I take. And some of them weren't planned. I mean, if you have a soil sample, you do an ICAP, you get those minerals back whether you like it or not. So what do? Do you have a look at it, or do you say, I don't need them, I throw them out? I hate to throw out stuff. And so I look at them, which ones are important. But then there are, based on the underlying science in soils, that, as mentioned, bulk density is just a really important characteristic of soils. And we don't want to disband it. And in this case, it showed bulk density drives some of the distances. We have half an hour, so just go ahead.
For those of you who just came in, our next presentation is canceled, so we're going to resume at 2, so we have time for questions.
Could you speak louder, please?
The next presentation by Van Putten has been canceled, so we will resume at 2. One question I have, or maybe not a question per se, but if you could comment on, in a study like what you have described, where we have these sites coming from land users that already been there for a while, it's not like we came there and randomly assigned certain site to be in a certain land use. I believe there is always a danger that there are some inherent soil or whatever environmental differences to those sites. They're already there, and even if we do, so we have our applications, we do compare our land uses, but how do we know how much of the difference is due to the actual land uses or how much of those differences is due to what's been there?
Joey, would you like to answer that?
Okay. Oh, sorry about that.
The question is, how do you know that the differences that you observed on the land use weren't already there and were not really caused by the land use?
Yeah, legacy effects, anytime you do these sorts of studies, there are always something that you can contend with. And there's no surefire way of removing those effects. Certainly adding ramifications helps to possibly remove them, but when you work in the southeastern U.S., we have such a dynamic land use history that there's no way to assure you. You know, for example, if you go into planted pine rotations and you've got tillage effects from when it was in row crop agriculture probably 20, 30 years ago across. And so it's certainly an effect, but you could argue based on the statistics that Dr. Van Zandt has shown that the grouping based on the current, which we consider long-term greater than 10 years, pretty decent grouping for the sweet crop is due to the size of the measure. So I think that's our best justification.
Thank you. Yeah, it's just based on experience that we have with our experimental site. Excuse me. We have actually replicated areas there that never been tilled before. It's that forests that just been there forever. And when we started to look at soil properties, we found that there is a very good reason why that forest been there forever, because nobody ever bothered to crop that land. It just wasn't, the soil was not good enough. So
the way this study was designed, it was all done on a fine farmland matrix. So the soils are used to walk the whole experiment to ensure, and the soils were sampled and verified to ensure it was from a mapping perspective, the same soil. So we try to take this complicated. Certainly soils are going to drive land use, but it turns out in that part of the world, you have multiple land uses, even over prime farmland soils.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And that's a characteristic of this Doherty Plain.
Following on from that, can I ask the question we were invited to ask, which is why the Gibbsite?
Okay. The Gibbsite question.
You would be better served for the S9 mineralogy, but if you're familiar with the Gibbsite, it's aluminum hydroxide, and it's typically considered to be an end product of long-term weathering, although there is a lot of evidence out there that you get relatively low silica levels and intermediate pHs. 5.5 to 6.5 for that part of the world, you can actually form rather quickly. And this is suggesting that perhaps gibbsite, the genetics of gibbsite or degradation. It could be the other way described as well. Seems to be affected by land use. I can't give you a perfect answer yet, but certainly it's going to give us some benchtop stuff to work on. But we do know the Gibbsite will form rather rapidly in the latter. And perhaps we are seeing some fairly quick alterations.
Yeah, we have a follow-up question. So in that, is it that the things that are causing the Gibbsite formation or degradation are correlated to the other properties, or is it that the Gibbsite is driving or vice versa?
Well, one thing that wasn't mentioned is as our once Gibbsite's removed, then you do have good set.
That's right. It's you remove Gibbsite from. Remove that variable, and there's no relationship.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're kind of doing is just take the Gibbsite out as a use and variant. You know, we tend to be use and variant think of things like texture and mineralogy as being our use and variant properties, or CDC on clay basis, which is a surrogate for mineralogy in the control section in the subsoil. It's clear here that Gibbsite may not be telling us we're just going to take it out of the use and variant category and just leave it with this. But I don't know whether it's a correlation or a truth.
And I can't tell. I mean, all I can tell is it's highly correlated with the differences.
Question somewhere else? Okay. Thank you very much.